Hi, I'm Dr. Kyla, pediatric dietitian, fussy eating specialist, and mum of two. I'm the founder of the online Mealtimes memberships that help parents just like you experience a confident and guilt-free way of feeding children. I'm also a business owner, a hot cross bun lover, and my superpower is finding things that you cannot live without. In this podcast, I'm talking about feeding your family, along with a random selection of topics that tickle my fancy. Welcome to Mealtimes with Dr. Kyla.
Hello and welcome back to the Mealtimes with Dr. Kyla podcast. Today I'm talking to Debbie Palmer, a highly experienced dietitian and team leader of the Nutrition in Early Life Research team at the Kids Research Institute Australia. You can read about her multiple roles in the show notes, but what you need to know is that she is doing incredible and life-changing research into nutritional strategies for allergy prevention. In honour of the Kids Research Institute celebrating 35 years of research next week, I am delighted to welcome Debbie to the podcast. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, how are you, Kyla? Lovely to be here and talking to you today.
I'm very proud to have you on the podcast. I think you're an incredible dietitian, incredible researcher, but also it is your first ever podcast. So I feel like this is a really special moment, maybe for both of us.
Yes, it is. Yes, so thank you. It's a wonderful opportunity to be able to do this podcast with you as my first.
Yes, and it's two Perth girls. I think that's a nice thing too. Do you want to start maybe, Debbie, just give us a bit of background into you. Tell us a little bit about your contribution, I guess, to the allergy research specifically, but kind of a bit about you as well.
Yeah, so my background is I'm a pediatric clinical dietitian, and I was working with families with allergic disease many years ago now, and really sort of finding that there was a lack of evidence about what we provided families, particularly for food allergy prevention. We really didn't know what to say. And so many pregnant women and mums who are breastfeeding and mums with young babies would come into the clinic that already have a child with food allergy, and they'd say, I'd do anything not to have another child with a food allergy. What can I do? And at the time, this was a while ago, maybe two decades now, but we had no good evidence. We had nothing that we could actually advise that we felt was based upon good research evidence. So that's what led me into research. And that's what I've been doing now for almost 20 years.
And now you can answer all their questions, I'm guessing, quite confidently. And I actually asked a few of my Mealtimes members if they had questions for you. And I've got some specific ones, which I can't wait to ask you at the end of the podcast. Shall we start kind of in Australia right now? What are our rates of food allergy? And is this kind of a stable thing, or are you seeing that change?
At the moment, we don't fully know, because we still really haven't done a full Australia-wide assessment of food allergy in the recent years. We know in a study in Melbourne where they compared the peanut allergy rate from earlier, about a decade ago, about the year 2011 to 2019, that there was a small decrease in peanut allergy rates within Melbourne. But we haven't really evaluated that since. So it's another 5-6 years and we don't know. We're hoping it's continuing to drop, but we're not sure. And we actually don't have an Australia-wide survey knowing all the different other allergens as well. So we're hoping that it's dropping, but we're not 100% sure at this stage.
Really difficult to do research when you don't have a starting point to measure from. Have we got a kind of estimate of how many babies are impacted by food allergy?
We think overall it's about 1 in 10 babies, and that involves all the different food allergens. The most common is peanut and egg allergies. So egg is actually by far the most common in young children, particularly those under 2. And then peanut allergy emerges from around the age of, well, any time in infancy, but becoming more common as children get slightly older. And the other big common food allergy in Australian children for young children is cow's milk allergy. And then we also see cashew nut allergy as a big emerging, unfortunately, nut allergy. We've now got almost equal rates of peanut allergy and cashew nut allergy in the studies that we've done. So this is a really concerning emerging tree nut allergy. And interestingly, this has also been seen in Europe. So recently, a big Europe-wide sort of study looked at cashews and walnuts and all the other nuts and found cashew was also increasing in Europe as well.
How interesting. Do they have any theories on why cashew would be changing in prevalence?
No, unfortunately, we don't know. We do know that cashew in Australian context is far more available now in our food supply. So we see many more foods with cashew available. And even more now, the recent trends on pistachio-related foods has become quite popular. And pistachio and cashew are very closely related from an allergen point of view. But we're not really sure why it's increasing, but it's definitely been increasing in the last decade for some reason.
Yeah, interesting. It's really unlocking all of these mysteries, isn't it? Australia is somewhat of a kind of allergy capital of the world. We have a reputation for having very high rates of food allergy compared to other countries. Any thoughts on why Australia is the hotspot?
Yeah, again, we don't know. If we could work this out, this would be the golden answer to hopefully then preventing food allergies. But we do think it's a combination. It's a combination of genetics and a combination of the environment. And one of the big sort of effects that we find or trends in Australia is what is known as the migration effect. And that is families who are newly migrated to Australia within the last decade, especially where the parents are born overseas, but the baby has been born here in Australia, they have some of the highest rates of eczema and food allergy in our population. And so we're not really sure, but we assume it's to do with the changing environment that maybe they don't, from a genetic point of view, and then, of course, the changing environment, our bodies just are not quite ready to accept these foods and then cause a food allergy. But it's quite common. Obviously, anyone can get food allergies, even if it's not been in the family history before. But often we see that families who have migrated, there's been no family history of allergy disease. And then when they move to Australia, their children have food allergies and eczema especially.
Wow, that is hard to fathom, isn't it? Such a big, oh, wow. Interesting. Okay. Thinking about these families who have young babies or haven't yet seen any emergence of allergy in their children, what do you wish that they knew more about in terms of preventing food allergy?
Yeah, there's two big things. Firstly, it's eczema care. And look, making sure that if your baby has early signs of eczema, that it's well treated, it's firstly diagnosed, and you receive good care and you carry out that care on the baby's skin. Because babies who have eczema, and unfortunately, the worse the eczema, then more likely they will have food allergies. So there's a very strong link, unfortunately, between babies who have eczema. So if a baby has eczema, and some babies have, you know, from quite a few, only a few months of age, they will develop eczema. Please seek advice and treat that eczema early. That will help. But then secondly, it's the introduction of the allergenic foods in baby's diet. And we've made a big change in that area, all based on clinical trial research over the last two decades. And we now know that babies should be introduced to the allergenic foods after they start solid foods. The allergenic foods shouldn't be their first food. And I think that's a really important message for families to know that they really need to start on other non-allergenic foods for the first few foods, particularly things like vegetables, cereals, baby cereals first, then start mixing in the allergenic foods. And so from around 6-7 months, babies should be starting on things like very well-cooked egg, peanut butter, mixed into their foods to make sure that they start on these foods and then regularly have them.
Excellent. I want to circle back to both of those points. But with that second one, thinking about kind of adding these allergens into the diet, I agree, like not having those first foods, because I just think it would be such a traumatic experience. I mean, this is from a purely a family point of view, is if your first food is a really common allergen and your baby does have a food allergy to that, it can be really hard to then introduce other foods, have the confidence to do that. Is there anything from a kind of scientific reasoning that you would delay it, you know, not being the first foods?
Yeah, one of the big factors is that you need to make sure the baby's actually developmentally ready to eat. And they can actually swallow the food rather than spit it out and unfortunately get it particularly all over their face or all over their hands or somewhere else. Because we know that skin contact of these allergens can actually increase the risk of food allergy. So if you think about it, if you tried to give a baby just some peanut butter by itself, for example, and the baby, the texture is quite difficult to eat, but also the baby then might naturally be not quite ready to swallow it, spit it out, unfortunately get it all over their face. And that will potentially sensitize them to the food and actually potentially lead them on a pathway of food allergy. So it's important that when we introduce these foods like peanut butter or well-cooked egg, that we introduce it mixed into a food they're already able to eat and swallow without it basically coming out of their mouth and all over their face. It's a developmental progression and not all babies are ready at the same time. And that's also really important to remember. But once baby can swallow some solids and do that consistently, then they're ready for these foods, but they must be well mixed in to other foods that they're currently eating.
It's a lot for parents to think about, isn't it? Those messages of like, let them play with their food, let them be kind of, you know, enjoying their meal times. And then also like, oh, the first few times really try to get it into their gut before their skin. You know, there's a lot, and there's only so much you can do. I really want to reassure families at home that you can, you know, do the best of what you can, and that is absolutely enough. When did it change, Debbie, from kind of, because we used to, the old advice was to hold off on allergenic foods in the hope of preventing food allergy. When did that kind of recommendation change?
Yeah, so a recommendation probably changed. We began to question it around the year 2008. And that's when we started clinical trials looking at the age of introduction of particularly of egg and peanut were the ones that were chosen because they are two of the most common food allergies. And we sort of soon found with all the results, when all the results of all these trials came in, there's four major peanut trials and nine major egg trials, including three trials in egg that we did here in Australia, that have shown us that when we introduce egg at around that 6 month age, as well as peanut butter, that will reduce the incidence of a baby developing food allergy compared to the old advice, which was to delay these foods in the case of egg into at least one. And in the case of peanut, our old advice in the year 2000 was actually to avoid peanut until children were 3 years of age. And that didn't work. And in the clinical trials, we've now shown that that's not the good way to go. And a new recent research that we've just published here in Perth, we've also found that when families do, you know, introduce the food around 6-7 months of age compared to around 1 year of age, we do see a dramatic drop in food allergy rates.
That's incredible, isn't it? I just wonder also what families were putting on sandwiches if they weren't using peanut butter before three. Like, it's such an easy spread. I was just mentioning before, there's just some recent evidence come out of the US as well showing a very similar thing, that the rates of peanut allergy in the USA have actually reduced since these early introduction guidelines have been in place. So it's nice to get some good news, I think, out of the allergy research space. I can imagine that's quite a challenge for you. There's lots of confounding factors to see some positive outcomes. I'll just circle back to the eczema one as well quickly. I'm not sure in your experience when you're working these clinical trials, but in my experience for families I'm working with, the eczema advice that is given out is wildly different depending on who you see. The diagnosis seems to be really hit and miss. A lot of people are like, oh, it's just mild, don't worry about it. And one of the things, kind of, I actually ran a seminar with Gemma Weidinger, who's a eczema nurse. I'm sure you know of her. She's just a life changer in the eczema space. And just the amount of information that parents don't get about eczema is a really scary thing. And from what you're saying as well, like a really big contributor to allergies developing because they're being given poor advice.
Yes, it's difficult because there's been a lot of changing advice over time. There's been misinformation, which of course, unfortunately, always leads to concerns. And unfortunately, with so much information available, it gets confusing. There is a really good website, which is also good for food allergy, food introductions, called NIPBUB. And it's run by our National Australian Allergy Centre, and it's evidence-based information, and that has got eczema care and eczema advice, which is always updated for evidence, as well as food allergen introduction. So that's a really good website for parents to have a look at. It's always been updated with new videos and infographics, and I think that's a really good source of information. And it's always worth, you know, getting second opinions if needed, if trying to ask around. But getting eczema care advice early is really important, even for mild eczema, because then, unfortunately, yes, mild eczema becomes severe eczema. And the worse the eczema gets, the more likely a child may, unfortunately, develop a food allergy.
Or what I find with mild eczema is that it just constantly simmers, right? So kids have these tiny little bits of eczema that don't seem to bother them too much, but that permeability of the skin really impacts their risk of developing a food allergy. And so the piece of advice I would really love families to take away is, even if it is mild eczema, we want to treat it quite aggressively and early and repeatedly. And I'll absolutely link to those NIP Allergies website, and I'll link to the resource that Gemma has done with me. And for all Mealtimes members, you get that included in your membership. So we'll link to all of those things as we go. Are there any allergies, Debbie, that we know we have more chance of preventing, or is it just the ones that have had actual research kind of done on them specifically that we know about?
Yeah, I mean, that's the tricky part because not all the different food allergens have been well researched. One of the ones that, or a couple of the ones that unfortunately is going to be harder to research are the fish and seafood and shellfish allergies, because for some reason they don't often occur in early childhood. And they sort of appear to occur later in childhood, in teenage years, or some adults anytime during their adult life. And this is something we really don't understand why that happens. In a recent study we did, in our study infants, most of them were introduced to fish and many didn't have fish allergies, so that's good news. But shellfish is not something that we commonly eat, and yet shellfish allergies are common in adults. So it's a tricky one. That's a really tricky one that we're still trying to work out how we can research the prevention and how and why it develops later in life compared to the earlier allergens. So we've sort of progressed a lot, particularly knowing about milk, egg, nuts, and we know that their introduction earlier in life can really prevent those allergies occurring. But yeah, fish and shellfish, it's a little bit trickier at the moment.
Interesting. There's an urban legend that the rates of shellfish allergy diagnosis on Christmas Day is a big thing, maybe the prawns, particularly in Australia, being a common Christmas food that you haven't eaten for a while. Any truth to that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone really documented it well, but it makes total sense because people don't eat shellfish very often. It's one of the times that you would eat it. And we do know the other allergens, particularly in baby diets, if you don't have it for a while, if you miss eating the allergen or the baby's not given the allergen on a regular basis, you're more likely to develop an allergy as well. So it's more than likely the effect that, yeah, when families sit down and have their Christmas lunch and out comes the shellfish, some people may have never had it before or they may not have had it for years. Yeah, it's likely to happen.
All right, if we think about these kids who do have a diagnosed food allergy, particularly with nuts, how likely are they to outgrow it?
So recent research has sort of been encouraging more than it was in the past, and now it looks like about 1 in 3 children with a peanut or a tree nut allergy may outgrow that peanut and or tree nut allergy. Unfortunately, it's only 1 in 3, but at least that's some children. We're still learning why those children do outgrow their peanut or tree nut allergy compared to those who don't. But we also know that unfortunately, if they still have a persistent peanut or tree nut allergy by the age of 6, it's less likely they'll outgrow that allergy. So those allergies that are outgrown earlier in life, so particularly before school age, more likely to happen, whereas those where it's persisting beyond 6 years of age, unfortunately, at this point in time, they may have it for life.
Is there anything that is available to those families who do have an early nut allergy to help at all, or is there hope in that space?
Yeah, there's big hope in this space. So a lot of work's been done in recent years, both here in Australia and overseas, looking at oral immunotherapy, and particularly for the nuts and particularly for peanut is where we're sort of starting here in Australia, given it's the most common and it can be lifelong. And so for children that are from around the age of approximately 1 year of age, there's a new program which has been rolled out across Australia in many cities, where babies have had the opportunity, it's on referral from their allergist, opportunity to participate in this oral immunotherapy peanut program. And it is where babies get given tiny, tiny amounts of peanut under medical supervision, and they slowly increase the amounts of peanut over a period of time. And the hope is that when it's given to babies young, like around 1 year of age, that it will hopefully develop the tolerance to the peanut. And this is really exciting and encouraging news for families. And there's a lot of work being done in oral immunotherapy, even for sort of slightly older children as well. But at the moment, the big hope is for the younger children who are diagnosed around the age of 1, that we might be able to intervene, so to speak, and to help them develop that natural tolerance rather than persistent allergies.
And so it's the idea for those younger children that eventually they would outgrow it once the tolerance increases?
Yeah. That's the hope. There's still a not. In some of the studies that were done in the past, it was done on older children and they didn't develop the complete outgrowing of their allergies. But we're hoping in younger children. And given we've learned more about dosing and frequency of the amounts, that hopefully we can induce more children to develop a tolerance and then hopefully have the complete outgrowing of their peanut allergy in particular. So we're really doing a lot of research now in that area, and hopefully that's encouraging. And there's always research looking at ways to try and reduce food allergy burden on families, and particularly hope for new treatments in the future as well.
And from what I understand, with those slightly older children, this tolerance building really reduces their risk of a severe immediate reaction, so that even if there was a small amount of contamination, their body could handle that.
Yeah, that's the idea, that even if they can't sort of fully tolerate a meal of sitting down with lots of peanuts in it, for example, or peanut butter toast, they can tolerate a larger amount. And so if there's like a trace of or tiny bit of peanut in a biscuit they're given or taken by mistake, then it reduces their chance of having a severe food allergy. And so it gives a bit of more protection or safety net around their allergy, so that even a tiny bit helps, and that just reduces the burden on families quite significantly.
Yeah, because the anxiety of, you know, sending your child to childcare or school where there's a risk that there's a small contamination that could, you know, have a life-changing effect is big for families. So it's really encouraging that that's happening in this space. Is it up to kind of allergists to decide who goes into these trials? Can parents ask for this? What are their options?
Yeah, so parents can ask their allergist about it. There is a waiting list, and of course, unfortunately, it involves a lot of hospital visits, and the program takes around 18 months at least. So it is a big commitment for families, but ask your allergist and they will be up to date of knowing what the waiting lists are like and if your child is suitable. So not all children may be suitable. So, you know, it's a matter of talking to your doctor specifically about your own specific child's situation, and they'll hopefully let you know what's available and when.
Excellent. I'm going to ask you some specific questions that came through from my Baby Mealtimes and Toddler Mealtimes members. Some of these are kind of individual child questions, so feel free to kind of talk to the bigger pictures. This was from a mum who said she'd like to know more about allergies appearing while her bub is only breastfed. So they hadn't introduced solids, but the baby had reacted multiple times to what they're assuming was almonds. So they saw a kind of a repeated reaction, and then reacted again after the mum reintroduced almonds to their diet after 2 months. So they saw a rash over the face, tummy and neck, and projectile vomiting. The advice this family has been given is to avoid introducing almonds through solids until 12 months. But this mum is worried about that increasing her risk of a longer term allergy. What's the kind of general consensus around that?
Yeah, this is one of the tricky areas still that we're still trying to sort of do more research on and to get better evidence and advice. At the moment, we know that the food allergens pass into breast milk. We know that, though, each woman is very different. If you eat the same amount of food allergen, you're likely to have different amounts in your breast milk. And we also may be seeing different amounts on different days. And we really don't understand this yet, but we're hoping. We're currently doing quite a number of studies in this area to try and really understand this in more detail. One of the things we do know, though, is every baby's different. But sometimes a milder reaction in babies, when you need to really know that it is actually a food allergy and it's not a coincidental baby symptoms. And that's really tricky because babies get rashes, babies vomit, babies have unusual poos and stools on a common basis. And that's sometimes just their digestive system getting used to foods. And there can be other things in the breast milk if they're totally breast milk fed. We know that even flavours and spices go through breast milk, which is often a good thing for babies to learn different tastes. But some of the other things could be irritating the baby's gut. So it's important to really know, is it actually a food allergen causing this, or is it just a coincidence? And we do know that when a lot of these babies are tested, it is a coincidence. Food allergy purely through breast milk is actually extremely rare. So it's important to have that checked out. And we also know it's quite transient. So for many babies, they even if they did have a food allergy, and often the common one is cow's milk, if they do have a cow's milk allergy associated with the cow's milk protein going through breast milk, they may actually outgrow it quite quickly. And so regular re-challenging of the mum's diet with small amounts of the cow's milk protein, building it up, can hopefully introduce that baby to the cow's milk protein again through the best breast milk and get them back onto that as quick as possible. It's really important to know it's not only the proteins that also their antibodies. So breast milk is full of specific food antibodies, which are also thought to really help a baby develop tolerance to foods. So yeah, it's tricky. Every baby's different, but our message is to really think through not having long delayed avoidance of these foods by breastfeeding and get the mum back onto those foods as soon as possible.
And I wonder for this, like it feels really risky to me to give advice to wait until a date, as we know kind of that longer period of not exposing them actually does increase that risk. I would probably feel more confident if this family had an appointment with an immunologist or an allergist and really had a plan for managing this, you know, even introducing at home. If there was a food allergy that has already kind of started in early infancy, the risk that that reaction is bigger is, you know, would you agree with that?
Yeah, they should be seeing an allergist around the time they're starting solid foods to make sure that this baby still likely has this food allergy. And around that time, hopefully even having a challenge to that food to know, you know, it could be given to the baby directly in a food challenge situation with an allergist, and then you know. But yeah. Ideally, you don't want to do it at home if you're not 100% sure what's going to happen because baby could have a severe reaction. But at the same point, delaying too long may be a problem. So but generally, if you put it back in mum's diet first, is the first step and see how that goes. But seek early advice and regular advice to make sure that you're not delaying the reintroduction if possible.
Yeah. And that was my next question. That was, is there evidence that reintroducing allergens via breast milk actually helps with tolerance?
We suspect so. There was a study done many years ago in the US where they looked at cow's milk in the mum's diet and taking it out, reintroducing it, and they found that the babies who had less time on avoiding the cow's milk had both higher, mum had higher levels of these cow's milk antibodies in her breast milk, and the babies had less, were less likely to develop cow's milk allergy in the longer term. So again, we're doing some active research in this area. But we suspect that a really limited period of delaying or avoiding these foods is ideal, and that these foods are naturally designed to go through breast milk and naturally tolerize the baby to develop tolerance rather than an allergy reaction.
Yeah, interesting. And I guess this next question feeds into this beautifully again. Great work from my members. I'm interested to know if introducing formula top-ups to a brand new breastfed newborn increases the risk of dairy allergy in the future. So this mum's son had formula top-ups until he was 6 to 8 weeks old. Then they were no longer required, so he was breastfed from then. He then had a reaction to dairy when we introduced it at 6 months. Is this gap in having the cow's milk likely a contributing factor to his allergy?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things here that we've learnt recently, which is really interesting. In fact, a recent study from here in Perth just published in the last week or so, looked at babies that have had infant formula in the first 3 days of life. So often it's now up to almost half of babies receiving some form of infant formula in the first few days of life. And this study looked at the babies who had the infant formula of some kind in the first 3 days versus those who didn't and that were exclusively colostrum breast milk fed. And what was really interesting is that the babies who had the infant formula had a higher rate of multiple food allergies, 11 times higher rate of multiple food allergies. And what's even interesting, because there have been previous studies to show that it does increase the rate of cow's milk allergy, but in these babies, they also had a 5 times higher rate of peanut allergy. This is really important for us to follow up on, which is what we're hoping to do, because it's sort of implicating that the infant formula, it's not particularly the infant formula that might be the problem, but that the babies are receiving less colostrum breast milk, the first breast milk, and this is a really important immunomodulatory nutrient for the gut, developing the gut microbiome, for giving the baby a really concentrated source of antibodies, and so as well as nutrition. So we think that the formula, it may not be just cow's milk allergy that may be a problem. It could be multiple food allergies that could potentially be triggered off by a lack of this colostrum milk in the first few days of life.
Interesting. And I wonder if there is I mean, we wouldn't know, but if there's a link between, you know, the recent changes where we saw an increase in the diagnosis of gestational diabetes because more the cutoff was changed, and this applied to me, I was diagnosed and probably wouldn't have been diagnosed with the now changed ones. But we're much more on the lookout for those babies of mums with gestational diabetes, looking at their blood sugar levels, measuring those. And I remember with my first baby having expressed colostrum from 36 weeks, but actually there wasn't any clinical guidelines as to how much to give a baby based on their blood sugar level. So she was given formula, even though I had colostrum. And, you know, in the moment of having a baby and all of the decisions, I didn't have a plan or I didn't know what to ask for. But it's an interesting one, isn't it? And I understand completely from a medical point of view as well. Like if a baby has low blood sugar, we absolutely want to be treating that appropriately. There's just so many things to learn, isn't there, to really make a positive impact for these families.
Yeah, it's really tricky because there are, you know, approximately 10% of babies who will need infant formula for medical reasons. But we need to learn more about reducing that amount. I mean, it's a lot less than, unfortunately, around the 40 to 50% of infants who are currently receiving that infant formula. And we need to probably prepare parents more in that antenatal period. It's not something that's often talked about or even thought about, you know, what might happen if the baby needs some sort of supplemental feeding or not. This is an area, again, where we're really sort of actively looking at trying to improve the situation to reduce the infant formula. And if mothers have some, you know, already expressed colostrum with them, that's a really good start. Or, you know, there's other ways in antenatal education we can try and reduce the reliance on infant formula, because unfortunately, it's now looking more and more like that is a problem, definitely from in the first few days of life for babies developing allergies, which is a concern.
Thinking then again about newborn babies developing allergies, we know that the advice is to go through the gut before having any kind of contact with the skin. I had a couple of questions and also my own questions around this. Lots of baby products containing food, proteins, baby sunscreens with coconut, you know, baby proteins, baby like moisturizing creams with things like oat. How is that kind of changing in the market, do you think? Like, we're pretty consistent with the evidence now that introducing food products through the skin is a problem. And then I guess my kind of second question is, I know there's some research in the NICU, in that kind of neonatal intensive care space, that contact with these newborn prem babies with coconut oil in particular on their skin actually has had some positive outcomes. Are we seeing this increase in coconut allergy in these babies? Is there a risk of these kind of food proteins doing damage?
Yeah, I think one of the things to think about is the food a likely common food allergen? So with coconut, it's actually a fruit and not a nut. And so a lot of people think coconut, yeah, it's a nut, but it's actually a fruit. And the incidence of coconut allergy is extremely low and rare.
Okay.
We're sort of encouraged that the use of coconut oil, and obviously the more pure the oil is, the less likely it has protein in it, which is a good thing. So it's the proteins that unfortunately trigger off allergy reactions. So having more pure oil products, they're less likely to cause a reaction. We haven't seen a spike in coconut oil or anything like that. It's obviously something to keep looking out for, but it's probably less likely a problem than rubbing other foods or getting other foods on baby's skin. And that's definitely, we've learned over the last decade or two, that that is a problem. And so one of the things we really also need for, you know, parents to know is, don't try the food by rubbing it or smearing it on the baby's face or hand or anywhere to see if they're allergic or not. But that's something that was quite common in the past, that families would try to, oh, I'll just try a bit, I'll rub a bit here and see if it actually causes a reaction on the skin. Now, it may cause a localized reaction, and then that may unfortunately put the family off introducing that food when it's just a localized irritation on the skin, which you can get with many foods, and you're not allergic. But also, most importantly, if the baby has the more permeable skin, particularly that eczema, you're actually rubbing the allergen into the skin, and you're really setting up that baby for a food allergy, unfortunately. I think the real key is not to put things on the baby's skin that's got food proteins in it. But if it's something like coconut oil, it's probably not so much concern.
I think if you doubt, just avoid it, use something else. It's also scary. It was only this week that I had a question in our member group where a family had been advised to just try a bit of the food on the skin. So it's absolutely still out there in the, you know, old school kind of approach to this. And it's very difficult. This is an area of ever evolving research and advice, very hard to stay up with, but it's tricky when that advice is so problematic and likely to really contribute to this. All right, my last question from members. IgE allergy mum of a 2.5-year-old has egg and cow's milk allergy but is expected to outgrow and is doing brilliantly on a reintroduction program. Cashew and pistachio allergy diagnosed as well, which interestingly from what you've said, Debbie, is, you know, on the increase, might be lifelong. The question is around the use of antibiotics during pregnancy and birth and the impact on the gut microbiome. Is this likely to be a factor in a child having allergies? And is there any kind of existing or future research into probiotics or gut health support, you know, in terms of outgrowing allergies or achieving intolerance?
Yeah, so I suppose firstly to touch on the antibiotic situation, there have been some really, really big meta-analysis in research looking at antibiotic use. And unfortunately, yes, there's been linked both directly to the baby in infancy and also during pregnancy to the mum. There's an increased risk of a baby particularly developing eczema if, unfortunately, they've had antibiotics. Now, we need antibiotics. They're important. It's not saying we shouldn't have antibiotics, but it can increase the baby's risk of developing eczema, which then, of course, can also then further increase a baby's risk of having food allergy. So trying to counteract that with probiotics or trying to improve gut health is important. It's just really complex because the probiotics, they're the good bacteria. There's many, many, many types. And we know that more diverse number of, so many more different numbers of probiotics in your gut, the good bacteria, is a good thing. So you don't want to just take like the supplement of one type and continuously take that, but it's not going to help. You need lots of different probiotic type good bacteria. But also most importantly, many people forget that they need to eat. The bacteria actually need to eat something and they need to eat prebiotics or good foods, often plant-based foods, that will actually to make them survive. They can't live there without food. So it's a combination of a good healthy diet along with the good healthy gut bacteria, and getting diverse bacteria is good. And that's good for anyone, whether it's a mum in pregnancy, whether it's an infant, to have a variety of plant-based foods in particular and other foods that contain these is good. Prebiotics is important along with a variety of good exposures to different bacteria. And we know that the bacteria respond quite quickly in the gut. So they change almost from meal to meal, day to day. So it's important that you keep thinking about that. And it's a lot of people do think about it and have, of course, antibiotics and try hard to improve their diet briefly afterwards. But then it needs to be an ongoing improvement to keep the healthy bacteria going, really, in your gut.
And that's a difficulty, isn't it? Because there's no threshold, or there's no guarantee. You can do all of the things and still end up with a baby who has a food allergy. There are times when you need antibiotics to, you know, save your life or your baby's life, and that's absolutely the priority. I really feel for families who have been through this path, because there's so many what ifs, aren't there? Do you know, what if we had this, or what if that had been different? And yeah, it's an area I think we're going to see a huge spike in research and outcomes, hopefully, in the next 10 years or so, would you say?
Yeah, definitely. We're still making good progress, and we've learned so much in the last 10 years, and we've got some really big studies running now. We're about to finish our big study called the Pregnant Study, which we've been running now for 7 years, I think, and we have 2,138 mums and babies around Australia, and that's been looking at how much dose-wise or amounts that mums eat of eggs and peanuts during pregnancy and breastfeeding. And we're less than 20 babies to finish now.
Wow.
We have results by the middle of next year or even sooner, hopefully. And that's really exciting. So we'll be able to, hopefully, from that study, get so big, all those families, we really appreciate their input and time into the study. They all have a history of allergic disease. So we know that whatever the result is, we will have a very good answer on that, which is really, really good. So we can, again, fine-tune advice, particularly for women during pregnancy and early breastfeeding. And now another big area, well, a couple of big areas we're researching is on the food allergens in breast milk. So we have a new big study called the Nuts for Babies study. And this study will ultimately involve 4,000 mums and babies. And wow, we're looking at, again, the amounts of peanuts, but also this time cashew nuts with the emerging cashew nut allergy problem in Australia. Cashew nuts in mums' diet from birth until 6 months postnatal. And looking at having these food proteins pass through breast milk, how much is a good amount, and what effects that has on hopefully preventing food allergies, and particularly nut allergies in babies again by the time they reach one. So we've got a couple of big studies happening, and we've also got a new field of research looking more into food allergy in the breastfed babies, the young ones. So we're going to doing some focus groups at the moment and hopefully launching a new study in that area again by the middle of next year. So there's a lot happening, and piece by piece, we're hopefully putting all the pieces of the puzzle together so that we can help give the best advice available. We've come a long way. But there is still many, many areas that we want to fine-tune and probably individualise as well, because that's, as you say, you can try everything and sometimes it's not a one-size-fits-all. Everyone's circumstances are different, everyone's genetics, everyone's environment is different, but we're learning a lot and we've made huge advances in the last
decade. You are doing incredible work, like just life-changing work. How do families get involved in this research? Can they register for a wait list? Is there somewhere they can go? How do they find out about this?
Yep, so there's a couple of ways. One of the ways nationally, you can get involved in any form of allergy research, and that includes even hay fever research, other types of research, is to look up. We have a National Allergy Centre of Excellence, and we have a website. It's www.nace, so it's nace.org.au. And on that, there are a allergy study directory. You can look up an allergy study directory. There's all and search for different types of allergies. You can search for what's happening in different states around Australia, for example. And then you'll find there might be something that's available for you or to at least to reach out to the people who are running the study. But there's quite a lot of allergy research, luckily, being done in Australia. And for another, for baby study, if you're pregnant, when you live in Western Australia and or in Victoria, just a selfish plug for our own study.
Oh, please, I'm going to promote it everywhere. So hit us.
We are recruiting now for another 3 years for the Nuts for Babies study. So we enroll mums late pregnancy. So if you're pregnant, then let us know. And you do not have to have a history of allergies for this study. Is open to any family, regardless of whether you're existing have any form of allergies or not. That's why the study is really big. We're going to have 4,000 mums and babies, but that's the study that, we're actively recruiting for at the moment. So reach out to us at the Kids Research Institute Australia and for the Nuts for Babies study if you're interested in that as well.
Excellent. And I can link to that in the show notes as well so that families can find that and be part of life-changing research. Incredible. Debbie, I feel overcome with just how much I've learned from this, how much I've enjoyed speaking to you. You sound like a seasoned podcaster, so I think incredible work. I think this is going to be so useful for families, and I'm really thankful for you coming on.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about these really important topics, and hopefully we can help some more families prevent some more allergies. That would be amazing. Thank you.
Absolutely, and I think there'll probably be more questions from this, so perhaps we can do another one in a little while and kind of touch on some of those. Thanks again.
Definitely.
A huge thanks for tuning in and listening to my podcast. This is all brand new for me, so I'd love to hear your feedback. Give me a review or send me a DM. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And above all, I'd really love you to hit that subscribe button to keep listening. Thanks.